You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Explore Ithaca's waterfalls, orchards, and craft beverage scene. Plan your getaway at visitithaca.com.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Handcrafted, expert approved, with over 20 international blind tasting awards. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. Hope everyone is taking time to take space for themselves. It is a very heavy and complicated time in the world. So please remember to be kind to yourself, to check in with yourself, your friends, your family, your loved ones. We are going to get through this together. Today we sit down with Isabelle Legeron. You might know her as the founder of Raw Wine. And we talk about the return of the festivals, her lifelong dedication to educating people about natural wine, and how and what you can enjoy to drink this summer. And then we go deep into the Brooklyn archives to hear from Waltz. It's a great performance, something we hope will lift your spirits on this Sunday or whenever you're listening. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Welcome to Snacky Tunes, coming from the beautiful countryside of the UK. Welcome,
yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you
it
so much.
It looks like a very sunny, gorgeous day where you are.
Look, I think it is probably the hottest day that we've had so far this year. We've hit 27 Celsius, which I'm not sure what's that in Fahrenheit, but it's not that hot in, you know, Californian sort of terms, but for us, it's very hot. You know, we feel very lucky whenever we can wear shorts and t-shirts in England. So we've got one of those days.
It's always nice. You're like, okay, I have four pieces of summer fashion. I'm breaking them out today. Crisp white in the glass. Very fun.
Absolutely. You never get rid of your winter wardrobe in the UK, that's for sure.
No. You know, my family lives on the East Coast, and I just have the one bulky coat, hat, gloves that whenever I got to go back to Philadelphia during the winter, I was like, well, I'll pull these out. So congratulations on the return of the Raw Wine Festivals. It's been so amazing to see them happening all over the globe, especially since you were off for a couple of years. I was lucky enough to be at the one in Los Angeles. What's the feeling been from both the producers and then the patrons who are coming to the festival as you've rolled them out in the last few months?
Oh, look, it's so great to be back, you know, on many, many levels. I mean, you know, look, I mean, first of all, I run really an events business. You know, Raw Wine is obviously much more than events, but essentially, you know, we kind of stopped working, you know, for over 2 years, and I kept the team going. You know, it's in total, it's five of us working. So, you know, everybody was so thrilled to be back on the road, back to seeing all the growers we work with super regularly, and obviously being able to see everybody attending, you know, whether they're from the trade or you know, wine lovers. So it was really amazing, you know, the first two fairs really we did this year were New York and LA back after the pandemic. I mean, we also had an event in Berlin in November, which was the weirdest event you would ever dream of attending, because we were actually the first event post-COVID. So we were the first event to close, you know, when London closed. It was literally like 7 days before in 2020, 7 days before COVID was kind of officially announced. So we were the first casualty. And with Berlin, we reopened, I would say, the international wine fair calendar. But everybody had to wear a mask. The police was all over the venue, and people had to wear the mask, wear the mask. Everybody had to be vaccinated. We had to test everybody before they entered the venue. So, you know, there was a bit of a futuristic, you know, like very weird, but the buzz was amazing. And in many senses, you know, people like the growers said it was their best ever event. It was so busy and buzzy. It was very euphoric. And it was the same in New York and LA, you know, in March this year. The events were smaller than what we're normally used to. But the buzz was incredible, and like the growers were so happy to be out and tasting and finally meeting people. So you know, they were very special.
Yeah. And you know, I know that you've really dedicated your life to educating people about wine and natural wine, introducing them to it. This must have been such a great reminder to see people come out and be so excited of why you picked your path in the wine world.
100%. You know, it's we all, the you know, the team and I felt so proud that we were able to put the show back on the road in a way and be able to get all these connections going, you know, with between the growers, the wine professionals, you know, people who love wine. And I think I hadn't realized how much the growers actually missed being on the road until I really spoke to them when they came to the fair. And I think it was the same for them. I think everybody had this sense of, you know, you realize actually we need this contact, you know, in this day and age where everything is about, you know, Zoom and all these platforms.
Yes. Yeah.
We're a bit fatigued, but we kind of think that everything is replaceable, and then you know, and to some extent it is. But I think when it's something like this, where if you think of growers, you know, a lot of them work solo or they work quite in isolation, I would say, where they don't really meet that many like-minded people in their village. You know, they always tend to be the outsiders. So when they come to a place like LA or like New York, and they are like in this sea of people who love their work, it feels great And we all need that, you know, because I think, you know, even though, of course, natural wine is, let's call it, you know, it's booming, you know, it's the growers are doing well and everybody's really selling wine and people are drinking a lot of natural wine. But still, I think it feels good to be reminded that there is a world out there who loves these wines. It's easy to forget, you know, when you go back to the vineyard and you get a little bit of, you know, there's frost and, you know, and then you don't see people and actually your neighbors thinks you're completely crazy and they want to grab your vines and all of that, which is a reality.
There
was this dual reality and I think sometimes it's, you know, so yeah, it was needed. It was necessary. It is necessary.
I mean, it's such a social endeavor, especially this type of wine making, where it's not just you're growing grapes, they're going off to some sort of corporate giant vat somewhere. This is more like an art of distillation that you could apply to either music or you could apply to cooking or something like this. And this is for people who want to go out and share what they've made with other people who really appreciate it. And when you don't have that social interaction for 2 years and you're sort of stuck at home, it can get very lonely.
For sure. And it's, you know, it's even more than that, you know, in a way, you know, that these growers, and I was reminded of this when a couple of days ago, I was in the southwest of France at Le Puy, you know, really a fantastic producer in Bordeaux. And then you're reminded that, you know, every single vine is treated as an individual, you know, as their children, as their child. Mm-hmm. So they are so focused on this, like you said, this art form, this respect for the living, that, you know, for them being able to share this, it's like, it's a bit like, you know, during COVID when you're stuck in the house. I mean, you've got kids. I've got a 2-year-old.
Yep.
You're stuck in the house with these, you know, 1-year-old, 2-year-old, and then suddenly you can go out and introduce your child to everybody. It's just it's a big deal.
So, you know, obviously a lot of people drinking became sort of a way that they could deal with COVID and booze sales were up, wine sales were up. But did that trickle down to the natural wine world, or did they have a different experience on the whole during the pandemic?
No, I think absolutely. I think this model of online buying during COVID went through all, I would say, all categories, and natural wine was very much that. I think there was a very strong support, and I know, I mean, you're based in LA, and I think a lot of, you know, the natural wine shops did, you know, curbside sales, and I think there was a lot of support for the businesses during the pandemic. But I know that online sales, you know, were booming. Online wine clubs specializing in natural wine, I know, also did really well. And things are changing now. People are going back to buying, you know, more at the shop, and you know, which is great, because drinking wine is also a social endeavor. You know, it's nice to go out to speak to the people who pick the wines, discover more wines that way. But there's no doubt that the pandemic, you know, was very successful for many online retail shops. You know, some growers, I know a lot of growers struggled because they were not able to meet their importers. They were not able to taste with them. So as a result, I know that some growers, you know, had and still have some stocks of wine so that they are now, you know, working through. And that's where you realize that something like raw wine, where you can come and present your new vintage, plays a big part in also the commercialization of your wine.
So much of the making and selling a wine is it's nonstop. It is always, there's something always going on. And, you know, the world stopped for a lot of us for a couple of years, or forced us to be at home more, things like that. Did you see, or were there any producers who used that time to innovate or reexamine what they're making and come up with a new wine or new practice? Have you tasted anything that was grown in the last few years where you're like, wow, like this wouldn't have happened if we didn't have a whole world shift in the way that we look at movement and being around each other?
Yes, lots of innovation. I think people suddenly had the time. I mean, I'm sure it's the same, you know, with a lot of us. You know, it's the same with me. You know, I was able to really rethink you know, in a way, my business and how we do things and change, you know, making improvements and develop new ideas. And for growers, it's the same, because for the first time in a long time, they were able to stop this sort of this race, you know, when you work in, right. in the vineyards and do the bottling and then go on the road to sell your wine. You know, I mean, for example, one of the, again, I mean, this is fresh in my head. So when I was at Le Puy, one of the experiments they're doing now, which is pretty awesome, is they have, they're doing a collaboration with a Swiss university, and they've installed some sort of like a weather station in one of the vineyards, but it's a weather station that captures spores. So they are able to detect whenever there is an onset of Oidium, for example, which is a fungus, mm-hmm. Where there's Oidium spores in the air. It tells them that suddenly, and they get the feed on their mobile phone, you know, the person who's in charge of the vineyards wow. has the feed on his mobile phone all the time. And then he's able to say, oh my God, you know, there's some spores in the air. Let's, you know, look at what we can do. So you know, and they were able to sort of develop that because they were a lot more peaceful, and they had the time to sort of to develop, you know, partnerships like this. So tons of people, and tons of people, I realize that maybe they don't need to travel so much. So I think now growers are also a little bit more. They've taken a step out, and I think people are enjoying the kind of slightly slower pace.
I've seen that with. Wine fairs, food fairs, art fairs, and things like that, with people being a little bit more discerning of where they go and when they go. It really felt that before, half your business was just being on the road and being somewhere. And now it's being able to be a little bit more picky and saying, I'm going to go to these five or six events, not all two dozen of them, but when I'm there, I'm really going to show up, which was indicative of the people you had at Raw Wine, because the right, I don't want to say the right winemakers, but the winemakers and the people I want to meet, I was like, oh, you're all here. You all came to this one.
Yes, I mean, it's true. You know, the event in LA this year was so well attended. You know, anybody who's anybody, I think, in LA to do with natural wine came to the
that's,
event.
That's which... the better way to say it. Anybody's anybody, not the right people. Yes, 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 yes. That's the classier way to say that, yeah.
But anybody who, you know, who's really interested and you know, came. And plus, I was really surprised, you know, some buyers who I would have thought, oh, they're a lot more in the traditional sort of, you know, stream of thinking and buying also came. So that's also indicating, you know, that there's a change and in a way we still have work to do. You know, I think the bigger picture for Raw Wine and the reason why I started Raw Wine is because I believe that, you know, by, you know, it's like, we can change the face of farming, right? We can change the face of viticulture. One glass of organic, natural, biodynamic wine at a time, you know, can have a big impact. I don't want to stop at, you know, the usual suspects, you know, people who always, you know, drink natural wine, people who you always see coming at fairs or you know, buying the wines, joining the club. You know, we have to expand. You know, there are more and more growers who are converting to organics and also embracing more natural wine practices in the cellar. And so we have to, you know, we have to keep going. You know, it's not like, oh, that's it now. Natural wine is super established. You know, the bigger picture is the environment. We really need to engage growers who are farming conventionally. They need to be inspired. They need to see that there is a market out there that people are interested. And of course, you know, maybe this is a cynical way of looking at it. And maybe people are going to be doing it for marketing reasons, you know, like converting to organic. But, you know, at the end of the day, maybe that's okay, you know, as long as they convert, as long as we can have an impact on the environment. You know, I think it's only like 5 or 6% or maybe 7% of the world's vineyards are farmed organically or something like this in terms of, you know, from an official perspective. So it's nothing.
I mean, I'll take organic farming with, even if it's served up with a side of cynicism. Sure. Whatever you want to do. As long as we get to better farming practices, I'll take it, whatever the approach is.
And that's the game, you know, for me, it's a tough road. You know, I mean, things look very different now from they did 15 years ago, where we were the crazy ones and the outsiders and the people with the insane ideas and, you know, wasting our times. I mean, when I became a master of wine in 2009, and I really was able to focus on the stuff I love, which was organic biodynamic farming and natural winemaking, you know, people were just calling me stupid. They said, you know, you're wasting your career. You've worked so hard at becoming MW, and then now you're just wasting it by, you know, going into this dark, obscure category. But for me, it was not a choice. You know, this is just what I wanted to do. So things have changed now, but still we have, you know, we still have millions of drinkers to convince.
Yes. Well, let's take a quick break. And I think part of the way that you're going to convince those drinkers is by the wine club that you just launched in the US, which I want to talk to you after the break. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on hrn.org.
Where a river starts, though I know nothing could be perfect. There's places we pass through on our journey through the rapids, and then takes a turn. There's some bands it goes to. Fresh water to salt. Now everyone controls you. Nothing could ever be stopped. I'll get confident. And this is where we had it all. Oh, after I implored you. Oh, in this river, it's a ride, and it's hard to our lives. Or we will be returned to the ocean. No, never thought it was wrong. River, yeah, got you. So stop! When the river came out to you!
HRN is home to transformative exchanges about food. We hope our diverse lineup of shows opens your eyes, educates, and empowers.
Thanks to HRN, I ventured into the world of cooking with sumac, and I have not looked back since.
I was listening to A Taste of the Past with my mom, and there was an episode about the history of American food. It inspired me to make it the subject of my final social studies project, and I ended up getting an A.
Join us during our summer membership drive by donating and becoming a member. Members play an essential role in keeping nonprofit food radio on the air. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member today. We thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Isabel of the Raw Wine Festival and also Wine Club in the U.S. I was brought into drinking wine through people like Justin Chernoff for Horseman and Jorge when he was at 10 Bells. And so to me, the only wine I really know is natural wine. Like I know there's other stuff out there, but I go, yeah, this is natural. Yep. Put it in a bottle. It's sort of done its own thing. Let it be funky. Let it ferment. That is not most people. So I feel very lucky and it's not very weird to me. It's not even weird. It's just like, this is just what I know of wine. I was like, oh, chilled red, serve it up. That is not the case with most wine drinkers. And I know that since education has been a part of your mission from day one, having a wine club seems like a natural fit. How did it come about? How is the education process? How are you getting people to buy in when they're like, I only drink a dry oaky Chardonnay that I got at Costco?
So you've had some great teachers.
I have been very, lucky. Very lucky. And congratulations to Justin and all of them for the James Beard win. But yes, I feel very lucky for my teachers.
Yeah, indeed. This wine club idea came about really from I had so many, you know, people come to me and say, look, you know, we love what you do and we'd love to be able to maybe drink more of that and have it available at home. You know, a lot of people will come to the fairs in New York, LA, and we've done it in Miami as well. But sometimes people come actually quite far away and they don't necessarily have access to good bottle stores. So the wine club really is a way of distilling all the stuff I taste. You know, I taste a lot of wine every day for you know, I do consultancy for some restaurants. Also, we have a wine shop in the UK, an online wine shop in the UK. So I'm always tasting. And so it was a way of, you know, for me picking six wines a month that I love. We interview the winemakers or the growers and we find out, you know, how they made that wine. So there's a lot of information about each wine, which we make available to all the club members. And then, you know, the idea is to pick wines that collectively make a great bunch. They make a great tasting experience. And, you know, they're all, I'm not a big fan of very, very flawed wine. So, you know, when I taste, I really taste for mouth. I make sure that the wine is really stable over a few days and that they're really amazing examples of you know, where they're from. So I also really focus on the farming. Obviously, the farming is really important. So the wine club is, you know, I mean, it's basically six bottles every month with tasting notes, interviews from the growers and
oh my God, that's amazing.
Loads of information. So it's a lot of fun.
That's so much fun. You know, when you start talking about natural wine and even if you know wine and, you know, ordering it, talking about it, going to a store, it can feel very intimidating. What are some of the tips if people want to get more into natural wine when they go out to a restaurant or they're in a store? Like, what are some of the key words? What can they ask? How can they sort of work with people who know a lot about wine to get them into this world, for them not to feel so, you know, afraid to talk about it or ask or say the wrong thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question, and it's something I actually feel very passionate about. I think we really focused on our intellect, you know, when it comes to wine. We actually taste with our eyes, we taste with our head. We don't really taste with our stomach and our mouth, literally speaking. You know, I think a lot of people, when they pick up a glass of wine, they look at the color and their mind is already made up as to what's going to be, what's what the wine is going to be tasting like. Whereas what I just really encourage, obviously when you walk into a wine store and it's a wine store that has a reputation for natural wine, I think just to have an open conversation and you know, don't be afraid of saying to people, this is what I like, or even be open to any experience, because, you know, one of that my best wine experiences were wines I tasted, you know, when I actually had zero expectation as to what I was expecting. So I think it's about keeping an open mind. And when you have a glass of wine in your hand and it's natural, it's alive, it can be different, and it's about tasting it like you're tasting wine for the first time. You pretend you don't know this drink at all. You just, you know, because when you drink cider or beer, you don't really have an expectation as to what tasting notes are going to come out of it, or you just enjoy it. When you have a piece of cheese, like a really great piece of cheese from a, you know, farmhouse cheese, you just enjoy it for what it is. And so I think the key is to just be very, you know, I don't know, just trust your instinct and not be drawn into, you know, one of the things that I what a little bit of my I would say, you know, something I find a little bit annoying at the moment is that natural wine has become very fashionable. It's very Instagrammable. It looks very beautiful, you know, with a, you know, a light background, all these, you know, orange colors, slightly cloudy colors, you know, and so on. But I think, you know, bottling, and that's what's happened, is that a lot of natural wines are bottled under clear glass at the moment, and which is really not very good for the environment, because you cannot produce a clear glass from recycled bottles. So every time you buy a bottle of natural wine under clear glass, it means that, you know, yes, you're like embracing a movement that is very environmentally conscious and, you know, all that, but you're also then saying, well, I don't care if people use recycled bottles or not. And you know, the growers hate this because the bottles are a lot more expensive. Obviously, they're a lot more costly to the environment, but that's what the market demands. So I think we need to start driving something a little bit smarter, and I think we need to realize that this has a big impact. So that's a little bit of something, you know, if we could start changing that and not put the growers in that situation, that'd be. But, you know, equally, if a wine is bottled under clear glass, they'll sell 10 times as many bottles. So it's like, this is what the market wants, but it's just a crazy idea.
Yeah, I mean, look, we all know where the wine goes, right into our, down the gullet. The bottle, though, especially after a big night, you're like, oh, wow, like this is a dozen glass bottles that need to get recycled and then not reused. So it's got to be seen as a whole collective. I know that you're also working on a series with the BBC on soil, which I think is really interesting because, as we've seen in America a couple of years ago, there was a huge fire up north and a lot of wineries were affected, and climate change and the environment. There's no way, especially with the natural wine, that's not going to have an effect on the industry. What are you focusing on in this documentary? Is climate change a part of it? How do you see the whole ecosystem changing, affecting the industry?
Yes, you know, so it's a series on soil, so it's for the BBC World Service. It's really about understanding the importance of, you know, what's underneath our feet. You know, it's one of the most unknown universe. It's teeming with life. It's also incredibly fragile. And it's, you know, it's what is partly responsible for, obviously, feeding the population. It's also, you know, a huge storage of carbon, which, if left undisturbed, you know, is basically completely, you know, sequestered in the soil. So there's many aspects to soil, and I think that the thing for me that I'm really focusing on at the moment is education. I think it's all very well to knock back a glass of wine and you know, have a lot of pleasure for it. But, you know, we also need to think about what that glass of wine represents and the farming conditions. And I think we need to start asking more and more questions, making sure that the wines really come from, the grapes used in that wine are really farmed properly. And the the idea behind the series is actually not really a series about wine. You know, a few days ago I was up north in Scotland. I was looking at a 10,000-year-old forest, basically the original forest in England, you know, after the glacial age. You know, sort of disappeared in Britain. Then forest grew, and then we got rid of most of it. But the whole of the islands would have been carpeted, you know, with these amazing trees. And then we dug the soil, we tasted the soil, and then we looked at, you know, how much life and you know, the organic matter, this sort of, you know, this the fungi, the connections between the tree roots and in between it, you know, between trees, and all of that web of life is incredibly important. And so this series, what I'm hoping will maybe I'm hoping that people will stop thinking that soil is dirt, that soil is dirty, but that soil is the source of life, and that, you know, we have to protect it for you know, a lot of reasons. And I hope that people will start falling in love with it and feel immense respect for this world that is completely, you know, absent because we never see it, but actually delivers so much. You know, even just like looking at your lawn and maybe not using weed killers or welcoming different species in your lawn, because what you want is you want a vibrant lawn, you know, where which is alive and teeming with life underneath. But if you start using fungicides and other, you know, weed killers and pesticides, then obviously you're killing life. So it's a really exciting series. And we're, you know, I was that's why, you know, I was traveling to Bordeaux also to look at what some growers were doing. Talking to, you know, people like Susan Simard, whose work on trees is quite incredible. So
I mean, that's amazing.
It'll be out in August.
Oh, in August. Oh, that's great. But I mean, we planted our first little garden in the back, and just to see things sprout. I mean, first off, I have a squash that's larger than my son that we just harvested, and you go like, oh my God, it's so, the connection and the beauty, even just a small little patch of land, you go like, oh, this is great. This is great. And just to take care of it and to treat it with care is, it's an important connection to have. And,
it really is, you know, it really is. And, you know, I know there is, you know, people are aware of the amazing energy trees have, and people, you know, go around hugging trees. But take your shoes off, you know, go and walk in the park barefoot, go in the forest barefoot, and just feel the connection and the energy. Put your hands in the soil, taste it. You know, it's incredible. You know, I never really, you know, we dug this hole in the forest, and there were four strata, and then we tasted our way through them. And it was incredibly salty, full of iron. You know, it was very, very much like fungus and almost, you know, like fresh fungus, the top layer, because it was all this fresh matter that had just been, you know, decomposed. It's incredible, really incredible.
It's amazing. So, look, I would be remiss if I didn't ask for some summer recommendations for wine. I know everyone goes to rosé, and that's fine, but a couple of bottles that maybe we can get in the States if you're looking to have a nice drink after you've put your feet through some soil and you've studied a little bit about where the wine comes from and had a little education. Back porch, sun setting, what are we drinking?
Gosh, there is a, I mean, look, that's a tough call for anyone. So some of the wines I've you know, recently, like, really loved, there is this Chilean winery called Viñedos Herrera Alvarado in Marga, and they make great wines. They even have a wine which has been fermented in cow skin, you know, the way it was done in the 16th century when they had nothing else but just cowhide. And they have this red wine, which is, I think it's called Rojo Loco, which is like 11-12% alcohol. It's basically everything thrown in, and it was really the way that, you know, they were making wine, you know, a long time ago. Is basically whatever was in the vineyard, collected at the same time, co-fermented, and this like really vibrant, juicy, red. You drink it slightly chilled. Completely zero. So that was that's a really fun wine, but plenty of wine. You know, it's not just like a glue glue wine. There's a lot of depth and complexity in there. What else?
Maybe a white. Is there a white that you've been drinking during the summer?
Yes, of course. I mean, millions. There's a winery I'm very fond of. In fact, they were in my inaugural April. We started the club in April, so you know it's like only three, it's only been going 3 months. But there is a winery in Andalusia in the south of Spain called Mucha de Alclapar. And they make wine with the Palomino grape, which is normally used for Jerez, you know, for sherry. But they make unfortified wine. And their wines are, they release their wines, like now it's 2017, 2018. So they release their whites after, you know, I would say a decent amount of aging.
Yeah.
And the whites are, you know, they're like, it's like being completely kissed by the sea. You know, it's like, you know, when you're by the sea and you've been for a swim and then you lick your lips and it's full of salt, of that really incredible salt. There's almost that floor, you know, which is what sherry is very typical of, you know, that biological aging. So it's there in the wine because it's there everywhere in the region. I think it's part of like the hallmark. Everything, the whole farming is done, you know, using horse plowing, is very gentle. And the wines are incredible. You know, they really take a lot of time to open. They're salty, they're deep, they're fresh, they're mineral. But the more they sit in the glass, you know, the more layers are coming through. So they, for me, they're really profound wines. And they come from a very unusual parts of Spain, which is known for fortified aperitif. But there's a new generation of growers in that part of the world who are reclaiming these amazing terroirs and these amazing grapes and doing something which I think in my opinion is actually a lot more interesting than just putting everything in huge vats or in huge, you know, in barrels and creating sherry, because that's been the tradition.
That's been done. Well, Isabel, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat with us. If people want to check out the wine club in the US, the wine shop in the UK, get information on the festivals, all the amazing stuff you're doing, read some of your writing, where can they go?
So everything is on our website. So it's rawwine.com, rawwine.com. There'll be stuff about the club, the shop, but also we have an amazing learn section, which is our blog area. And we organized recently a big digital conference on the life of plants and how plants are alive. And we have about 35 hours of amazing speakers, Susan Simard, really top writers. And everything is available online now to be streamed. This incredible content, all the videos are there. So there's a lot of info there.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Oh my God, thank you so much. And thank you for having me at the fair. I can't wait to come back when you're in LA. We have a
we'll
song. You'll be there when?
Yeah, we'll be there in November. So we're back in November. Mm-hmm.
Yep, November will be fantastic. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on hrn.org.
Yeah.
It's a look that you give me, I see it deep.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca, helping you to plan your next getaway. Ithaca has waterfalls and wineries, art and theater, outdoor recreation, and family fun. The area is famous for its glacier-carved gorges, co-op-run businesses, and cultural influences from Cornell University and Ithaca College. The area is well known for its local cideries, which are leading the way in America's cider revival. You can hear from the region's cider makers directly on HRN's series Hardcore. There is something really special about Ithaca's climate for cultivating delicious apples steeped in history and terroir. The second season of Hardcore is out now. You can learn all about apples and fermentation and dive into how cider makers and their communities are working to create an equitable industry and one that is resilient to climate change. Listen to Hardcore on your favorite podcast app.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. 818 is created from fully matured blue agave from the Los Altos and Valles regions of tequila. It is then slow-cooked for over 30 hours, extracted using traditional Tahona wheels, distilled twice in copper pot stills, and aged in American and French oak barrels. This process creates the best tasting, highest quality tequila possible. Their tequilas have received over 20 blind tasting awards. They strive for excellence in every sip. 818's Blanco is sweet and smooth with undertones of tropical and citrus fruits. Their Reposado is soft and balanced with notes of caramel and vanilla. Their Añejo is elegant and velvety with crisp herbal notes and a warm vanilla finish. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their tequila and find it near you. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
We got Walt live in studio. Welcome, boys.
Hello, thank you.
It's good to have you here on this early August breezy weekend. What's really great about the project is that there's a really strong aesthetic that comes with what you're doing, and I'm curious where that comes from and what some of your influences are.
I suppose it's from certain theatrics. I'm not sure. I like sequins and extravagant garments, I suppose. More than anything, it's just to have a bit of fun, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I know that you part of the upcoming release in the fall is a feature-length film. Where did the inspiration for that come, and how did you put that together in connection with the album?
Well, the album was done first. We tracked upstate New Paltz with Kevin McMahon, and we had like 12 tracks, and then we started to develop video content, and then it sort of grew into this monstrosity. 65-minute VHS film. So it sort of started with a small piece and then eventually became much bigger, you know.
What was the decision to jump from like, okay, we'll do a small thing to like, yeah, we're going to just set this whole thing to video?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things that just sort of happened over time as it developed. It felt a little cheap to just put off a couple tracks as videos. We felt more inspired to make a full-length sort of body of work that we could sort of, you know, really tell a few different stories in, instead of just kind of making videos for the singles.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a few clips for the upcoming movie, but what are some of the stories that you're focusing on for the videos, or what's the narrative that you're telling?
Yeah, it's a little strange. I suppose essentially it's a workout exercise manual, sort of set in 1984. So it's one of those sort of throwback pop. It's a collection, I suppose, of VHS is essentially the focus point for me. It was like really sort of creating something that was a piece of time, you know, and something that I appreciated from that era. Like, I like those old, really hyper-cheesy visuals that come with the 80s, you know? So mm-hmm. We kind of essentially built this 65-minute version of that.
Any particular favorite exercises that came from that, or exercises that didn't work, that didn't make the cut?
Well, I'm trying to think of the name of the tool. The Thighmaster was one of the highlights for me personally. Yeah, it was exciting. It's actually quite difficult.
Is it really?
Oh yeah.
They make it look so easy on TV.
No, it's not easy at all. It's very difficult.
What are some of the tips for using the Thighmaster as a pro now?
Control, I suppose. Yeah. They're not very stable. It's very sort of, you know, you'd imagine that it'd just be a matter of sort of control and motion, and it's not the case. The things are very, very janky. You end up sort of doing more damage than good. Now, this is not supporting the Thighmaster in any way. But I do, you know, it was a good thing to try. It looks good. That's the main thing for us. It was more of a visual.
Visually, it's stunning. I would think that the rubber on the skin would hold it in place.
Yeah, but then you get sweaty, you see, and then it starts to slide out of place. And then, you know, and then it ends up like a spring.
Yeah,
actually quite dangerous.
Yeah. All right, well, why don't we hear a song, and why don't you tell us what exercise our listeners should be doing while listening to the song?
Well, why not try the Thighmaster to this one?
Okay, great. And you're listening to Waltz Live on Snacky Tunes.
Oh, baby.
Awesome. Hope no one got injured out there with the Thighmaster.
Me too.
So I know that you recorded the record upstate. What was the process like and being a bit removed from the city and putting the record together?
It was middle of winter and miserable in that sense, although great at the same time. However, it was very cold. So we were tracking to tape, which is just not worth it. But we had like 15 minutes in, 15 minutes out, just to kind of warm up physically. But it was one of those things where we dealt with it. It was just very, very cold. And the producer had budgets on heat allowance.
Really?
Yeah, he wasn't really too comfortable. He kept on... We'd come back. We were sleeping there. It's a barn, so it's a large barn.
How long were you up there for?
About a week, I think. And he'd sort of sneak back in and just check if we had the heaters on or not, because he is...
Like dead of the night, like we'd walk in and just see if the...
Oh, yeah. Just popping in just to make sure, you know?
Like, hey, guys, brought you some beers and just wanted to make sure that...
Yeah.
It looks... We agreed at 72. It looks like it's at 78. We're just going to knock this...
No, he basically wouldn't allow it to be on in the first place. So. But it was one of those old, you know, those really expensive electric ones. So.
Saying recording to tape, I mean, now having gone through the process, do you say it's not worth it now and that if you did do it all again, you would just go digital, or it was good to do? And
it's good to go. I mean, we were under the impression that we were listening to mixes from the tape sessions, and it wasn't until, like, a few months ago that we were like, the producer was like, you know, these are all digital bouncers.
Oh.
And we're like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, yeah, your tape was shedding and it wasn't worth. And I'm like, well, you didn't tell us.
Oh.
You didn't let us know. But in comparison, I think it was good exercise wise to have the 15 minute sort of blocks, you know, where you sort of on and then you can sort of, you know, it's more execution based performance for me. You know, as in, like, we're rolling, you know, as you've got 15 minutes to do a job and then you can, you know, reset. So that was good. I mean, the digital recording process I haven't really delved in too deeply in a big, like, sort of production sense. But having unlimited time sometimes can be dangerous, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I am a big believer that constraints really push creativity. So, you know, recording a tape in the dead of winter probably is a little bit different than, like, summer, upstate, digital, just, like, long, lazy days type of vibe.
Yeah, although that sounds good.
Second one.
Next time. Yeah.
I do think that there is something about the cold that just really just, you know, accelerates, like, hunkering down and really kind of diving into it, as opposed to, like, just a lazy... endless kind of meandering of time.
Yeah, it's time to show up and work, and that was good. That we, you know, we got a good result because of that, you know.
How many takes were you able to do per song given the according to tape?
I think we tried for like four or five. You know, you generally we had a clue, you know, when you know, we had a good idea when we when we had something we liked, we moved on, maybe got another try, but then we generally just kind of kept it moving, you know.
Got it. All right, well, let's hear another song.
All right.
What is the exercise to be done to this one?
The exercise to be done to this one is what?
Cross-dressing.
Oh, excellent exercise.
That is a very tasty exercise.
Yeah.
December, when I met this baby, around the back by the swing set. Oh, Caroline. Oh, kick you, Caroline. Caroline. You go up that I kick Caroline. Caroline, she's not my Caroline. Ooh. So I went down to the local muscle store and started lifting pound for pound to get my Caroline back. Oh, well, I packed on 20 pounds, the toughest muscle that I could find. And now it's time to find my Caroline.
Who's Caroline?
Caroline is a fictional character, I suppose. Caroline is a mess. Yeah, Caroline is she's a beautiful lady, but a lady of mystery and a lady of wealth, but she's a definite mess. Yeah.
Okay. So you have a show coming up August 12th. What can the audience expect?
Yeah, we're playing at Rough Trade August 12th. The audience can expect some entertainment. It should be a good night. We're really excited about it. We've got a fun show that we're excited to, you know, bring.
Is there, if you could encourage the audience to participate in any way, how would you expect them? Or what would you ask of them?
Well, I suppose... G-bangers. Yeah, what would you suggest, Ian?
Maybe some G-bangers.
And yeah.
You can bring your own weights.
Bring weights, G-bangers, and Thighmasters. We will have an aerobics prelude. And we will basically be scrapping the show and working out.
That's the biggest hustle. There's actually just show up with just a suitcase full of weights.
Yeah, that is it. If you show up with a suitcase full of weights, we will let you in for nothing.
Oh.
And you can join us on stage.
That's a good deal. So I want to make sure that we have time to get one more song in, but when can people expect the record out and the film out, and how can they follow along to make sure they don't miss it?
Well, we're going to put the film and record out in full. So, you know, late sort of September, October. And yeah, you can follow us online. We've got a bunch of websites that you can surf and gather important information. You can track us down on there, and then, you know.
Where is that?
Never miss a beat. Facebook, Instagram.
The name.
Oh, the name of the
Facebook. What is it right now?
Jeez. We're on Facebook.
All right,
we've established that. We are. I think it's I Am Walt.
Okay.
It's the Facebook landing page.
And you can go down the rabbit hole from there.
You can definitely find it out. Or you can go to Waltz for Life with a 4, not a F. LYFE, to make sure you
totally miss it. Can't find it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks to Emily for helping set this up. Thank you to The Infatuation. Shout out to Darren, Anna, Ornella, Mom, Dad, Joe, whoever else is out there. What are you going to take us out with?
This is a new song called Water Park, and it features a fourth member, and she sounds like this. Another actor seems to have lost his leg, but apparently he's keen to sign on for the second season. China! Sucker.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.